Some delegates say they'll be packing heat. Dozens of lawmakers are sitting it out. In short, this is no ordinary Republican National Convention. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me now from Cleveland is WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Dave, what's it look like in Cleveland right now?
Well, I'm at the Arena Hall where they're taking a bit of a break. Outside, it's pretty much a normal downtown. Things seem pretty calm. There's a lot of traffic cops out, and now and then you'll see a cluster of four people in tactical gear, but it looks pretty under control. There have been protests, but nothing noisier than what we saw on the convention floor this afternoon over the rules battle.
One of the party's VIPs, House Speaker Paul Ryan, addressed the Pennsylvania delegation today. Now, why would he be speaking to them?
Well, yeah, he can't be everywhere, and Pennsylvania is an important state. It has a lot of uncommitted delegates, some of whom have some ambivalence about the nominee, and Ryan is a prominent leader who appeals to everybody. So I think this is a measure of Pennsylvania's stature that he was there on the first morning of the convention.
As such, what did he have to say?
Well, it's interesting, Dave. He spoke for about 15 minutes, and it was nearly over before he finally uttered the name Donald Trump. And I think if you listen carefully, you could hear Ryan drawing a distinction between his approach and that of Donald Trump.
We will not win an election by default. We will not win an election by just saying how bad the Obama years were and let's just win by default. We will win an election if we give this country a really clear choice.
And what I think Ryan was politely noting there was that Donald Trump promises to make big changes in his speeches, but it's fair to say he's thin on how he's actually going to accomplish them. Ryan says he and his Republican colleagues in the House have developed some very detailed policy proposals on fighting jobs, fighting poverty, even an alternative to Obamacare, which he noted has taken 6 years. And he said that's how the party will get across the finish line in November, by giving people a clear and detailed alternative.
Now, many of these delegates were uncommitted. Dave, were they ambivalent toward Trump?
A lot were, but I'll tell you, there is some real enthusiasm now. You take Ash Kari. He's a 60-something-year-old engineer from Warren County in western Pennsylvania. I spoke to him months ago. He was not particularly a Trump guy. He said he would go where his voters took him. But I spoke to him this morning, and, well, we'll just listen to this.
You will tell your grandkids and great-grandkids that you were there in 2016 when the change took place. This is almost like when we signed the Declaration of Independence. One-third of the country was against it. And so today, a lot of people are against about Donald Trump. But you know what? This country needs a kick in the pants at this time.
And so Ash is all in. And there are some delegates, particularly from suburban areas around Philadelphia, not particularly Trump enthusiasts, but they are more or less coming around now.
Let's talk more about this Ash Kari, one of the delegates who said he'd apply for a carry permit to bring a gun. What happened with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I spoke to him last week, he said, Dave, don't ask me about that. Well, I asked him today, and what he said was, all I'll tell you is that I got a permit. I'm not going to say whether I'm actually carrying. I don't want to be a target. But when I started to walk away, he waved me back, and he said, I just want to make it clear, I'm not a vigilante. I'm a concerned citizen who's concerned about my safety, and I don't want an OK Corral shootout in Cleveland.
Dave, what's on the agenda for tonight?
Well, we'll have a lot of speakers. The theme of tonight is keeping America safe, and so we'll hear some folks who have connections to the violence in Benghazi, which took 4 American lives. And, of course, the big speaker is Melania Trump, the nominee's wife, and we'll be hearing from her.
To be introduced by her husband, one Donald Trump.
Indeed, it'll be interesting to see whether he is carefully scripted and using a teleprompter or whether he wings it and makes some news that his handlers aren't expecting. It'll be fun to watch.
Stay tuned. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies, who will be with us throughout the week. The majority of Republican members of Congress from Pennsylvania and New Jersey are skipping their party's convention in Cleveland. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports on the various reasons they will not be joining Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention.
Party conventions are a time to unify and hopefully spark a flame that propels the party's nominee into the White House. But most members of Congress skipping the festivities say they're not trying to distance themselves from Donald Trump.
No, I'm heading to the Middle East.
As of right now, it's not in my schedule. I have various meetings that are scheduled back in the district.
No, I'm more of a home guy. I prefer to be in Bucks County than anywhere else.
That's Pennsylvania's Pat Meehan, New Jersey's Scott Garrett, and Mike Fitzpatrick, also from Pennsylvania. Only 6 of Pennsylvania's 13 Republicans in the House have confirmed they're going, and Senator Pat Toomey, running for re-election this year, is not. In New Jersey, only 1 of 6 Republican members of Congress is attending. Pennsylvania's Charlie Dent says he's not going because Trump has yet to win over his support.
My concerns with the presumptive nominee is that he has made a number of incendiary comments, whether it's on the disabled, POWs, Mexicans, Muslims, women, too few policy specifics, and at times the few policies that he has presented have often been conflicted or contradictory.
Dent says he had hoped to attend, but only as a part of an effort to derail Trump's nomination.
Well, I had intended to go to the convention had it been an open or a contested convention. I was a strong supporter of Governor John Kasich. And once it became a settled matter that we have a presumptive nominee, that I felt there was no longer any reason for me to attend.
Other Republicans from the region, like New Jersey's Leonard Lance, are supporting Trump, but say they have their own re-elections to worry about. Lance says he thinks the party is coming around to Trump, though.
I don't think we're completely unified yet, but I hope we will be unified. I think it's important to elect a Republican president.
Then there are those who are eager to attend.
I'm proud to go and be part of my party. That's kind of exciting to go.
That's Tom MacArthur, New Jersey's only Republican congressman who is going. He says attendance was a no-brainer.
I'm a new member of Congress, and this is the first presidential convention since I've been here. The Republican Party has been having conventions since Abraham Lincoln. First one was 1856.
MacArthur says he's excited to spend time with local delegates while also having some fun.
I want to support the Jersey delegation. And we have a lot of people from the state that will be there. I did tell them I want to get a selfie with LeBron James. Why not? I'll be in Cleveland. Get a picture with the king.
As for Trump, MacArthur says he's not worried about sharing the ticket with him this fall.
Nobody is going to confuse me for anybody else.
While retiring Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick is skipping the Cleveland festivities to spend time with his family, he says he's looking forward to showing Democrats around Philadelphia next week.
And I've been telling my friends on the other side of the aisle to give me a call when they get in town, and I'd like to show them the sights, not only the city of Philadelphia, but Washington Crossing, Bowman's Tower, New Hope, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. We've got a lot to see up in Bucks County as well as the region.
For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Philadelphia officials named 9 community schools today. It's the first step in Mayor Jim Kenney's push to create 25 such schools over 5 years. Now, what happens next? For that, we turn to WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
City Hall announcements have a certain rhythm to them. Rehearsed speeches, a few inside jokes, polite applause. It was all going according to script until Dr. Tony Damon, principal at Morrell Dobbins High School in North Philadelphia, took the mic.
I'm standing here all composed, but on behalf of my colleagues, we are super excited. So just thank you all.
Education initiatives don't usually inspire that kind of enthusiasm, but the community schools concept is different. It's touted across the country as a way to address poverty, violence, and other ills that keep low-income students from learning. Through the initiative, Philly hopes to turn public schools into neighborhood hubs for support services, almost like community centers. The mayor's office has selected 9 schools initially. They are Dobbins, Kensington Health Sciences Academy, South Philly High, Tilden Middle, Edward Gideon, Southwark School, F.S. Edmonds, James Logan, and William Cramp. They represent a wide range of neighborhoods, from gentrifying South Philadelphia to Upper North Philly. The budget for year 1 is $4 million, but Susan Gabreski with the Mayor's Office of Education says that instead of an appropriation, each school will get a site coordinator to determine what the school community needs and how to get it.
That will include balancing what philanthropic resources are available, what corporate partnerships are available, and what we'll look at is what programs we need to expand in order to be able to get these services.
No one really knows what those services are yet, and the first year will focus on analysis and planning, city officials say. So if you're expecting a lot of shiny new things in Philly schools this fall, the message from City Hall is clear. Don't. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
A Ahead this evening, we'll turn back the clock to the dawn of manned lunar exploration.
I think if someone were to offer me the opportunity to travel to the moon on that technology, I would definitely turn it down in exchange for my smartphone.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. After this weekend's horrific killings of police officers in Baton Rouge, NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones has one question for the man police identified as the shooter.
I wish I could have talked to 29-year-old Gavin Long before he died in the Sunday morning shootout in which he allegedly shot and killed three Baton Rouge police officers and wounded three more. Had we had that conversation, there is only one question I would have asked him. Whose side are you on? Because this much is clear. If you kill police officers, you can't possibly be on our side. Randomly killing cops isn't protecting the black community. It's endangering the black community. When you do so, you encourage your enemies to do the same. You undermine your message. And while the Black Lives Matter movement does not condone such shootings, those who would devalue black people will point to Gavin Long to falsely paint the movement as violent. We must reject such notions. Then we must look at the realities that created this anger. When the Washington Post finds that unarmed blacks are five times as likely to be shot and killed by police as their white counterparts, there is a problem. When whites can't accept the disparity because they have never seen an unarmed citizen treated that way, there is a disconnect. And beyond the data, beyond the disconnect, there is rage, there is hopelessness, there is grief. The videotaped deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile only add to that volatile mix of emotions. But the killing of police officers is not the answer. In fact, such killings endanger all of us by drawing dividing lines in the blood of the fallen. In the horrific aftermath of such violence, perhaps those dividing lines can become building blocks. Perhaps in our shared grief for the black men and the officers who have died, we can find common ground. Perhaps as we prepare for yet another round of statements and funerals and tears, we can tell the truth. Justice in America is not and has never been equal. But if we truly want to change that inequality, we must acknowledge it, we must address it, and we must fix it. Doing so will be the highest tribute to the police officers and civilians who have fallen in this new struggle for justice. If we don't want to honor their lives by addressing the system they died for, then we must ask ourselves a pointed and uncomfortable question. Whose side are we really on? I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Immediately after Friday's failed coup in Turkey, President Recep Erdogan blamed Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish imam who lives in Pennsylvania. Previously, Erdogan accused him of conspiring against the Turkish government from his home in the Poconos, but this time Turkey plans to formally seek extradition, as WHYY's Edward Saakashvili reports.
Mere hours after regaining control of the country, Turkish President Erdogan was already pointing his finger at Pennsylvania. Over the past few days, he has repeatedly asked that the U.S. extradite influential cleric Fethullah Gulen, who lives in a compound in Sailorsburg, about 30 miles north of Allentown. Gulen and Erdogan used to be allies, but they've grown into bitter rivals in the past few years. That's Gulen speaking with reporters on Saturday. He said he doesn't think that the U.S. will extradite him, but if it does, he will not resist. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the U.S. is still waiting for a formal extradition request. Once that's received, Kerry said authorities will base their decision on the strength of the evidence. Basically, the evidence that Gulen plotted the coup has to be strong enough that he would be indicted in the American legal system too. But even then, the U.S. might not go along. The allegations against Gulen are widely viewed as politically motivated, and the extradition treaty with Turkey allows the U.S. to deny extradition if a crime is political, says Princeton University's Kim Shepley.
Basically, the U.S. and Turkey have said, we'll turn over someone to you as long as the crime that you're charging them with is not considered by us to be a political offense.
Shepley teaches sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School. She thinks that unless Turkey puts a tremendous amount of geopolitical pressure on the U.S., Salzburg residents are unlikely to see their reclusive neighbor leave anytime soon. For WHYY, I'm Edward Saakashvili.
Sunrise, Sunset, the title of a timeless tune performed by countless singers since Zero Mostel's Fiddler on the Roof rendition in 1964. Helping us consider how much more swiftly the days and years could flow is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, we get one sunrise and one sunset per day per paying customer. However, sentient extraterrestrials get a buy one, get one free experience.
Two stars can have either a planet or more than one planet orbiting those two stars, thus creating the two sunrise and two sunset situation. However, astronomers recently have identified a star system 320 light years away from us in the constellation Centaurus. They've been able to identify a really unusual situation where there is a planet that actually can have three sunrises and sunsets in a day.
Because there are three stars?
Imagine it as a star like our sun with a planet, but not too far away, there would be two other stars orbiting around each other, and then that two-star system and our single star and planet system are orbiting a common center between the two. So that when we're around on one side of the planet, not only do we have daylight from our star on that daylight side, but the other star system is close enough to us that the light from that star illuminates our night. Now, that would be for half the year. As the planet then rotates around to the other side of its parent star, then you have a situation where you're looking at a night sky for the other half of the year for half of that diurnal cycle for that planet.
As is our wont this time of year, let's pay tribute to what is inarguably one of man's greatest accomplishments now 47 years ago.
Yeah, we can put all those things together and see that on Wednesday of this week, we celebrate, as you said, the 47th anniversary of humans leaving this planet to visit another celestial body. Not too far away, our very own moon, 239,000 miles away. The first astronauts that stepped on the surface of the moon spent on that mission 21 hours on the moon. And of that 21 hours, only 2 hours and about 15 minutes were spent out on the surface of the planet. Neil Armstrong walked 196 feet away from the lander. But if we go 3 years later to 1972, the Apollo 17 mission with Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt spent 3 days on the surface of the moon. And of those 3 days, 22 hours was spent out on the moon. A remarkable achievement. We haven't been back since.
All the more so given the technology or lack thereof in the late 1960s and early 70s.
It is astonishing, astonishing that they were able to accomplish so much using that technology. I think if someone were to offer me the opportunity to travel to the moon on that technology, I would definitely turn it down in exchange for my smartphone, which has far more computing capability than any of those computers at the time did.
There were six visits to the moon. Were they all in relatively the same neighborhood?
No, they were scattered all over the surface of the moon, in fact, all over the near side of the moon, the side of the moon that we see. And the intent was to look at different geologic locations to learn as much about the moon as possible.
That they were all on the near side, are they theoretically all visible to us?
Yeah, indeed. In fact, they are all visible to us if we just knew where to look. And in fact, we can find them. A small telescope, not even a big telescope, any small telescope will get us a closer view of those locations. But you'll need a map to find them. Sky and Telescope magazine has a really great photographic sort of map sequence, if you will, of each of the six locations with instructions for how to get you to those locations. We're coming up to full moon this week. It's a great time to try to look.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Arms that can only lift a spoon. Everyone's gone to the moon.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. Streets full of people.